The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is the Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of the Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. In this hour, we'll be speaking with Bruno Hinojosa Ruiz, co-director of CIMA, Compañeros Inmigrantes de las Montañas en Acción, about some immigration situations in Western North Carolina, organizing here in the case of Elmer Reynoso Reynoso, a Guatemalan-born resident of Weaverville who was recently released from detention after public outcry and pressure.
First, we would like to briefly announce that longtime revolutionary and former political prisoner Bo Brown has just been diagnosed with a condition which is very similar to Parkinson's disease. She has always worked tirelessly against racism, sexism, homophobia, and transphobia, and has brought awareness and attention through all means to the plight of the prisoner. Since being in prison is an experience which is designed to follow everyone for their entire lives, let's help this comrade with her current situation. For more information and to donate, you can visit ucaring.com/bo-brown-655777.
On Wednesday, October 12th, alt-right, anti-Semite, anti-Muslim, anti-feminist, white nationalist Milo Yiannopoulos is speaking at Western Carolina University. He's being sponsored by the College Republicans at WCO in Cullowhee, about an hour drive west of Asheville. To get there, one could travel west on I-40 for about 25 minutes and then out US 74 south for 35 minutes. It would be a pity if this stop on the, quote, dangerous faggot tour, unquote, were to be disrupted by anti-racists. Just saying. But first, some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Oh, come like a boss. So far, the mainstream media hasn't even mentioned my run for president. You would almost think that the institutions of the established order aren't taking me seriously. You would almost think that 2016 is a two-horse race. And the crazy thing is, as you look at the corporate party candidates, I don't think anyone could possibly write a better argument against hierarchy. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are underwater in terms of their popularity. That is, their unfavorability ratings are higher than their favorables. So in an election between just the two of them, it really is a matter of choosing the lesser of two evils for the entire electorate, who must vote for the candidate they hate less. This is perfectly understandable if we look closely at the candidates. Hillary Clinton's politics are most closely associated with Bill. Her husband, who bombed Yugoslavia with depleted uranium, destroyed the U.S. social safety net when he signed so-called welfare reform into law, enslaved everyone to corporations and corporate interests when approving NAFTA and other trade agreements, and turned the already fascist-leaning federal court into a dystopian nightmare when he signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. The corporate party designations of Democrat or Republican aside, the Clintons have long been opportunists of the worst kind. Hillary Clinton backed the oil wars and the Patriot Act as a senator and doubled down on military misadventures as Secretary of State, while her philandering husband used the Clinton Foundation to sell access to the privileged and wealthy few. About the only argument Hillary Clinton has for becoming president is that she isn't Donald Trump.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
And so we get to that orange billionaire with the badger stapled to his head. This guy actually says what all the wealthy exploiters are thinking, what they would usually only admit if you spiked their caviar with dexedrine. Like all the privileged, Trump hates everybody. Latinos, blacks, the poor generally, folks with disabilities, anyone with a vagina, unless he's currently using it. It's like he's got a gumball machine for a head. You just twist the crank and everything in there just comes tumbling down the chute and out the trap door. Trump's populist pandering, completely superficial and absolutely tone-deaf, directly contradicts what his improvised rants really reveal about him. Without any kind of plan or comprehensive strategy, it seems that Trump intends to make America great again, whatever that means, by getting elected and then figuring it out. His argument for getting elected is that he's entitled. Personally, I wouldn't trust that goofy bastard to run the drive-through window at Taco Bell. Interesting, both candidates become more popular when they are out of the media spotlight. That is, they seem better the less they say. By all indications, the only way for either of them to become even marginally tolerable to the people who plan to vote is if they completely shut up until November 8th. And yet, they both keep talking. In the meantime, I'm up against the fascist bozos of intimidation, shutting down my communications in a corporate-owned mainstream media that won't even mention my name. The most frustrating part of it all for me is that now, more than ever, if poor deluded hierarchs were aware of the choice to dance naked around the bonfire where the White House used to be, I have no doubt that they would write me in. I think there's little doubt that it's time to flush the whole system like a goldfish. Having said all of that, some good news. I have it on good authority that I'm guaranteed to win overwhelming majorities in several states. You may have heard that hacktivists managed to penetrate voter databases in Illinois and Arizona. Well, that was followed by compromising the voter databases of at least 18 other states. So, through the magic of modern technology, I could theoretically win overwhelming majorities in as many as 20 states. You know, thanks to my Russian pals Boris and Natasha. If Donald and Hillary split the remaining 30 states, do you know what anarchist with two thumbs becomes the last president of the United States? This guy. Remember the 8th of November. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio, running for president of the United States in November, and I approve this message.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, C.I., P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message. I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
We're speaking with Bruno Hinojosa Ruiz, community activist and co-director of CIMA. Thanks a lot for taking the time to talk, Bruno.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about CIMA? What does it stand for and what the organization does?
Yeah, so CIMA is Compañeros Inmigrantes de las Montañas en Acción. And it's an immigrant rights organization here based in Asheville. And it's been around, it'll be 13 years now in October. So we've been... So what we do is we connect, strengthen, and organize communities to take action for immigrant rights here in Western North Carolina. So it's pretty much community organizing and focusing on advocacy for immigrants in Western North Carolina.
And by the acronym and the language of it, I would imagine that it's mostly within. Oh, what does the acronym stand for?
So CIMAS, it's immigrants or Compañeros Inmigrantes, Immigrant Compañeros of the Mountains in Action. Whereas before, CIMA was actually working with organizations and their bases to organize them around to advocate for immigrant rights. It's now focusing more on individuals, either that be allies or the immigrant community itself, grassroots base for the most part.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So not just like networking different existing groups, but actually doing the work itself and planting down the roots.
Yeah.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw on the website that CIMA, which I didn't know the word before, but CIMA is like mountaintop?
So it's the mountaintop of, yeah, it's the mountaintop. So it's kind of, the name itself is pretty, it's pretty cool.
To,
you know, kind of gives it a little.
It's like regionally specific sort of. And then.
Yeah.
Also, like, it's a peak.
Cool. Yeah, it's the people are the peak.
That's
And
because of the language of the acronym and the title of the group, I imagine the majority of engagement you do is with Spanish-speaking immigrant populations.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any plans or possibilities of reaching out to Ukrainian or Russian populations around here, or maybe South Asian? I don't know.
I think sometime maybe in the future, but I think right now we're still focusing on that sector, and then I think essentially or eventually will be reaching out to those folks as well. It's just a little bit different, I think, for the most part, since Latin American immigrants, for the most part, are here in a different circumstance than maybe Ukrainian and other folks. Not the majority of folks there. Yeah, there's some certain issues that are more focused around the Latin American community.
So I would imagine some of those include incarceration, deportation, interaction with police. Can you tell listeners on that note a little bit about Elmer Reynosa?
Yeah, so some of the things that we actually focus around is, for instance, anytime an anti-immigrant bill comes into the state, the region, we try to engage folks to advocate and against those kind of bills. And another thing that we're focusing as well is to end any Bolimigra, which is the ICE and police collaboration in the area of Western North Carolina. Mainly right now we're focusing on Buncombe County and how in other counties around those that tends to play out. And then another piece is, of course, helping with some of these folks that are being detained with immigration in these detention centers. For instance, the most recent case that we have was Elmer Reynoso, who was a youth who came in 2014 to reunite with his family. That, you know, his mother, he hadn't seen his mother since maybe 7 years back. And he came in as an unaccompanied minor, which in 2014, it was like a huge wave of these unaccompanied minors that were coming to the U.S.-Mexico border to come in and asking for asylum pretty much. And what we saw with those cases was that some of these youth were not getting the appropriate legal representation. And for the most part, these cases tended to either their lawyers were telling them that they needed to, ask for voluntary departure, which without even trying to fight for their cases. And sometimes folks were actually just taking their, or lawyers were taking their money and just not doing anything. The case with Elmer Reynoso was that they had talked to a lawyer, and this person was actually working in with their case, but it came to they have to go to these court hearings in Charlotte or wherever their closest immigration court is, and so Elmer had to go to Charlotte to represent his case. Well, they pretty much lost contact with the attorney, and the family itself felt like they were paying the attorney, and the attorney wasn't doing anything. Mm-hmm. So this led to Elmer Reynoso not going to his court hearing in Charlotte, and therefore it automatically turned into this...
Like a warrant was issued.
It was pretty much asking for Elmer Reynoso's to detain him. So at the beginning of January, President Obama and DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, they started doing these raids all across the U.S. And we didn't hear anything until June, which is when immigration was in the area. And prior to that, we did see a couple of immigration officers here locally in downtown Asheville. There was conversation with the sheriff as to whether he knew why they were here, and he just said that they had a meeting, but it was nothing about immigration related. Which
so ICE agents, they were just like, yeah, so barbecue, huh?
I guess so. I just wanted to have a picnic or something. Mm-hmm. But then in June, so June came and Elmer was picked up as he was leaving his house. He was on his way to work around 7 in the morning. And a couple of days after he was detained, we heard also that 3 other people had been picked up. But Elmer was then taken from Weaverville, was picked up by some ICE agents or DHS officers. He was first detained in Winston-Salem. So Winston-Salem was the first stop, then York Detention Center. And then 2 weeks later, he was taken to Stewart Detention Center, where it's the biggest detention center where most folks go from South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina. And he was there for a couple months until the community outside was fighting for his case. Ever since he was detained, a group activated. I believe the first weekend, we were able to collect around 400 postcards signed by community members saying, you know, for Mark Meadows to take action on his behalf. On Monday of that Monday, we went to his office trying to deliver these postcards. Apparently no one was in the office, even though we had heard some people inside the office. So it was just these actions that took place in and outside of the court for him to be reunited with his family 4 months after he was detained.
And what's Mark Meadows' position?
So Mark Meadows, he is the U.S. Congressman for, Weaverville, where is one of his counties. Representative. And he's, apparently he's very, he's not anti-immigrant, like, hardcore, but he's definitely not, he's not for, like, bringing in refugees. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an interesting conversation to be having with him as, you know, saying, could you help this young man? You know, he didn't do anything wrong. But from the get-go, he was always like, what did he do? What, you know, what, why is he in detention?
As if there was something attached to, like, him committing a crime and, like, hurting someone.
Right, right. It's like what you told him, apart from him, you know, not have done anything wrong, is apart from missing that one court date because of lack of representation, there's nothing else. Like, he doesn't have a record or anything. And not like that for us makes a difference, you know what I mean? We would try to advocate for any community member.
Not just the quote-unquote good immigrant.
Yeah, I mean, because for the most part, we feel like everyone deserves a chance to stay and fight for their case. Because, for instance, like the other three people that were taken in June, they had DUIs in the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. And they had gone through all the process. You know, they had gone through rehab and everything. They went through court, and they were fine at the end of the day. But immigration still came around and said, hey, we're going to take you because 10 years ago you had a DUI. Mm-hmm. That seemed pretty unfair. And I believe that those folks are now okay, because I want to say that one of the people that was taken up had some heart problems. Mm-hmm. So he had like a surgery coming up the following week that he was picked up.
Okay.
And so immigration was like, okay, we're not going to touch you, but you still have to come to court.
Mm-hmm.
But they had, I think that they spoke with a immigration lawyer, and they said that, you know, they were, I think, in good hands. But yeah, just I think immigration doesn't really care who the good quote unquote people are or not. So we're trying to advocate for any individual that, you know, deserves to stay here with this community and family.
You mentioned like him, Elmer was reuniting with his mother, who he hadn't seen in 7 years.
Well, yeah, since he was little. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's 18 now, right?
Yeah, he actually turned 19 September 1st.
Okay.
In detention.
Oh, damn.
But yeah.
Happy birthday. Can you talk about, and you use the word refugee, can you talk about maybe like the circumstance that some of these people were trying to get away? Like there's the running towards your mother, like these sort of like, and family relations, those are things people run towards. But as a refugee, they're seeking refuge from a circumstance. What is, for instance, Guatemala or Honduras or some of the places these people are coming from? What are they like right now?
So there's a lot of gang violence for the most part. And for instance, in Guatemala and Salvador, and that's actually something that Elmer was not only coming here to reunite with his family, that, you know, his mother he hadn't seen in years, but also he was fleeing from this gang violence. And also, financial circumstances too, but there's a lot of people that are either being killed on a daily basis and are seeing this violence, you know, increase in their countries. And people are just fleeing, you know, those circumstances. And they want to come to the U.S. because family or friends that are up here, and they want to reunite with them.
But I mean, just to put it out, like, crossing the border doesn't sound like a very easy venture. It sounds like an expensive and dangerous venture. And it's not that, and I'm sure this is me stipulating, but I would imagine a lot of people that are crossing the border, even if they have family on this side, don't necessarily want to be leaving their home. Like, in a lot of cases, don't want to, you know, go away from where they've grown up and where a lot of their other family is, but are sort of forced to because of these circumstances of immediate danger of, you know, violence of...
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about people who are coming in from, for instance, Guatemala. You not only have to, you have to cross Mexico, which is also a dangerous border between the southern countries and then the U.S. and Mexico border. So you have to cross various places, and it is expensive. I mean, I think prices range from anywhere $7,000 to $10,000 for people to, to do that trip. And it's not only costly but also dangerous. And you never
know. And not just because of like the border patrol, but because of the people that are bringing you too, right?
Or just the, I mean, the places that maybe they're taking people in for, maybe through deserts, maybe through the trains, that come from Honduras and Mexico and Guatemala and all those places there. It's a dangerous trip, a dangerous adventure to take, I would say. Yeah. And some people don't know whether they're going to make it or not. But I think because of all those factors, having maybe you're being threatened by a certain gang, or you just don't know what your circumstances will be. You just want to search for a better life, better future. And it seems like the U.S. is the way to go, or northern countries are the way to go.
Mm-hmm. So a few months ago, I got to talk to some folks. I was in Europe for a radio conference, and I got to talk to some folks that were doing migrant solidarity work there with folks from North Africa and folks from the Mideast who were trying to make it into Europe. And one of the many educational parts for me of the conversation was hearing people either from those European countries, or we got to hear someone from Sudan get to talk about his own relationship with imperialism and the impacts of imperialism and what those European states had done to create or foster some of the chaos that exists where they were coming from, that they were running to Europe to escape. Do you have anything to say about like American intervention in Central and South America and how that impacts and economic policies and how that impacts destabilization of those areas? It's kind of a big question, but if you have any thoughts.
I mean, I think it's similar to those countries in the Western hemisphere too. Not only imperialism comes into play, but also then the treaties that were made, like NAFTA, CAFTA, and how all those have made a big impact on countries in South America, and why the economies there are the way they are, and why people rather come to a country where they know nothing about, and they know that it's a lot of opportunities. And so a lot of people then do come up seeking those opportunities in a country where they don't know anything about. And then imperialism, I mean, it's such a complicated kind of thing that, if you look at the history of Latin America, it's always been, it's been there since, it was colonized, and all the resources were then taken out from the continent onto European land. Yeah, I don't know. It's a very heavy, heavy subject.
So that's amazing that through community advocacy and pressure on officials that Elmer was able to get released. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there are other folks at CIMA is working to get out of detention or aware of. I saw a flyer online today for Pascual Andre Felipe.
So as far as people in here in North Carolina, I think there's a group, it's the NC6. So there were 6 youth that were in the same situation as Elmer of this year, who were detained since January, some of them. And they were in Stewart Detention Center for almost 6 months. And I want to say the last month or so, because of public pressure, not only at the local level, but also DHS and immigration offices and officials, they were able to get them released. But as far as we actually went, me and Elmer's family went to a vigil in Charlotte on September 17th, where we met up with other family members whose, children were also in the same situation as Elmer at the time, who were in Stewart detention for almost, you know, 4 to 6 months, and they didn't know whether they were going to stay there. You know, they didn't know their situation, but it was a neat experience for, I feel like, for the family to get to interact with other folks that are in the same situation and kind of, like, even get inspired, you know, to say, you know, this is what we've done, this is what we're doing, we're not giving up. But also to kind of be one voice for these youth that are in, that were in this situation, and to publicly say, you know, we want you, immigration or immigration officials, to let these youth out because they're not, you know, they're not any threat to the government or anything like that. So some of these folks actually have been released. I think Pascual, they're refusing to release him. I'm not exactly sure why, but I do know that the first case of someone being released out of these six youth from that campaign, where they gave this individual a $30,000 bond, which is outrageous, mm-hmm. just because, you know, he had no record. He was just a youth coming into the U.S. and fleeing from, you know, violence or whatnot. And
so is that after, like, if you were to go through a bondsman, would it get dropped down to 3,000, which is still a huge amount of money, or that's the amount that it was 30,000?
No, it was 30,000. So, for instance, this person, this youth was in Stewart Detention Center, and they were fighting for him to get a bond hearing, to have, you know, to be released so that he could fight his case outside of detention. And immigration finally said, okay, we'll let them out, but he has to pay $30,000. And people were able to raise this money through, you know, a crowdfund site, and people were just that had been helping these youth wanted to, you know, to make that a possibility. So they were able to raise that $30,000. In other cases, another individual who I think we know a little bit more about was Wilden Acosta, and he was able to get a $10,000 bond. Again, after a lot of pressure from, you know, from the community and organizations that were helping him, advocating for him since he was detained. And for instance, with Elmer, like, we were able to, since he was detained or taken from Weaverville, we were able to get this community organized to a point where we were asking Mark Meadows first to be the voice to talk to immigration on his behalf. He was, you know, not so sure as to whether or not to help us at first, but then he did have a conversation with immigration, or his office had a conversation with them, just requiring information about his case. And then we also asked local officials to step in and do the same. And we know a couple of local officials did that. The next step was to, you know, talk to immigration officials themselves. So we had press conferences. We had people calling the director of immigration. And then the last thing that we did was emailing the person underneath the director, which was Alejandro Mayorkas, the person that's taking care of immigration under Jane Johnson. So that's the next person. And also the lawyer. So Elmer had a lawyer 2 months back that we were able to get for him, and that part was a big help. Not only because he needed a legal representation, but because this person was also the lawyer that helped with Wilden's case, which was a big help, because if we were to get another lawyer that had no idea, you know, it could have turned out into something different. So with the legal representation inside and the public pressure, those two components, you know, we were able to get Elmer's hearing and get him out without paying bond. So he got out on September 22nd. They told him that same day, you know, hey, pack your things, you're leaving. And he thought that they were kidding. He's like, no, you're joking. He's like, no, you have to go. Like, you're leaving, you have to pack your things. And then he called his family, his partner, and his mother, and they were all taken, you know, by surprise, because no one was expecting this. And so he called them and said, you know, have you heard anything? Has anyone called you all? And they said no. And then they called a lawyer, and the lawyer also had no idea. So then they called I get a call from them, and I'm the same. Like, I don't know anything. We were expecting maybe a response 2 or 3 weeks later, mm-hmm. After we send an email to Alejandro Mayorkas. But it was just all, it was exciting to hear that he was out, and thanking all the community efforts to push for him. And I know that right now there's also from those, so in June, we from the community here in Asheville and in Fairview, we know that four people were taken, including Elmer. Two of those people, I believe, are fine. One of them still in Stewart, unfortunately. And the mom just reached out to us again because we lost communication. So she reached out to us a day before Elmer was released. So right now we're trying to also see to what capacity we can help them, and trying to see if, Elmer's family wants to also help them, to see what all happened, to give them an idea, and also Elmer's family is willing to kind of be a support for this family.
Really important.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the idea, help us help you, mm-hmm. in a way, and also building capacity around that area.
Yeah, it seems like once you've got the experience of helping to get one person out of detention, and you've built professional relationships with folks that are either working within ICE or DHS or whatever, and lawyers on the outside, then suddenly it's not just like somebody coming up and like saying a name to one of these officials, but it's like, oh, this person from this group with this lawyer, like, what's up, Mayorkas? Like, hey, here's another case. Like, can you?
And I think we were, something that SEMA does is we work with regional organizations and also national organizations. So I think to that extent, because of those networks, we were able to communicate with people that, knew or had contacts with in D.C. and knew who to contact on the Department of Homeland Security, what emails, what phone numbers to call, those kind of things. So those were definitely important things to have. And just those networks are crucial, I think, when you're trying to multiply your message. So yeah, that's pretty exciting.
So on the show, we've been talking over the last few months a lot about incarceration in the U.S. Because there's been a nationwide prison work stoppage that a lot of people have organized in different facilities, just mostly around the 13th Amendment, and saying, well, like it says that if people are duly convicted of a crime, they can have labor extracted from them and basically be a slave of the government. And when you start looking at who gets picked up, who has contact with police, who's less likely to have resources to be able to hire a lawyer, the intersections of racism and class in the United States, and gender and all these different things, it impacts certain populations. And so it does seem like a caste system is being perpetuated in the United States around that. So we've been talking about prisons. We've been talking about some private prisons, federal and state facilities. One thing we haven't really talked about very much has been immigration detention centers. Mm. So the one that Elmer, from that Univision video that I saw, mm-hmm. they had a picture from the outside of an immigration facility that had a big CCA on mm-hmm. the water tower. So that's the, I'm totally remembering, Corrections Corporation of America. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about where Elmer was kept and like what the conditions were, and maybe go into what sort of impact there is on the people that are being held there to just being in this like limbo situation? Mm-hmm.
So from things that I know and things that Elmer shared from his experience too, so the Stewart Detention Center in Georgia, in Lumpkin, Georgia, he was there for a couple months. And so he was telling us, that ever since he was transferred from York County, South Carolina, to Stewart, that they had them chained up from, hands to feet to their waist. And that in the meantime that they were transported from one way to another, which it's a couple of hours, they told them that they had to, they told them they had to eat that in that area and in that way. So not being able to actually, eat while chained up seems pretty just dehumanizing. Cruel. Yeah. And then, I mean, you know, being in those private detention centers, just being in contact with your family is also kind of, they're making a quick buck out of it for sure. Just with those phone companies and the way that they have it set up. But, you know, the food that they would get is also, you know, it's like quick, you know, stuff that you put in the microwave, like those little soups, and then you just heat them up. And that's supposedly like the best stuff that you can get. And he was telling us, you know, that people in the detention center would actually all get together in one table and put everything, all that they would get, and put it together and make this bigger thing out of it, like a big meal. And that was, you know, so, you know, people inside are still trying to fight.
Fight the, like, dehumanization and, like, form community and stuff.
So, yeah, I mean, and he was then telling us, like, you know, that people had been there. He knew a couple people that were in there for maybe 12 months, that, you know, there was people from the Haitian community, people from the African community that were, you know, just waiting for to hear more about their case, and but that they were there for 12 months or if not more.
And this is maybe someone who's, like, visa lapsed or, like, they missed a court hearing, and this is...
Yeah, and that's like you said, they're in limbo, so they don't know what they're doing yet. These private corporations are making, you know, a ton of money out of these, out of the beds that they fill in, and just the certain things too. I know that with Wilden, because there was a lot of things that were happening with his case that they put them in what's it called?
Isolation.
So they put him in isolation because they wanted to punish this individual. So sometimes they put them in. And these
basically it was coolers. Called like the hole or whatever, right?
The hole, yeah, the hole, and sometimes they put them in like even coolers. I know that they do that a lot in the border, like Mexico U.S. border, where they put them in coolers and then they're there for hours, just to punish people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you try to, you know, organize within the community within the detention center, they seem to punish you. Or I know that Elmer was also mentioning to us that they were trying to, like a group was trying to organize maybe a hunger strike from within. And he said that never happened, but that they were trying to get media coverage of it. And I think that was a couple weeks before he got let out. I wouldn't wish that upon anyone.
Yeah. And by the nature of it, not only because of the corporation that's running it, but it's like prisons are meant to invisibilize people and how they're being treated, which is a part of the horror of it too, is that there's not like public oversight.
Mm-hmm. I want to say that the past couple of years in legislation, North Carolina legislation has been very, you know, anti-refugee, anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ. So there's been a lot of hate bills coming into play. I think before HB2, there was an anti-immigrant bill that was passed by the governor also, HB 318, which doesn't allow for people to use the matricula, which is like an ID that you get from the consulate. Apart from your passport, it's mainly with a Mexican consulate, I think, that you get it. But apart from the passport, you can get this matricula, which in certain cities... for instance, like Greensboro and some parts of Charlotte, where you were able to use as an ID with certain institutions and certain organizations. And also, apart from the matricula being prohibited from being used, also organizations, organizational IDs, which I know in Greensboro there was a big ID organization that was, you know, being used within certain institutions and banks and schools in the Greensboro area. And so that bill was pretty much saying...
It has to be a government-issued ID. It can't be any of these others.
Right. And whereas before you were able to use the matricula, I know the passport's still, you know, effective, but it's still kind of iffy what in certain areas, maybe in the western or the eastern part of North Carolina, how this law impacts, you know, how people are being registered in school or just in certain, you know, banks, institutions, if you can still, if people are still being able to use certain IDs. So that was a big thing. Other than, you know, people don't have a driver license since they can't have a driver license, And that was something that happened since 2005. So that was another part of, you know, another ID that people were able to use, but now, you know, people don't have access to that. So, you know, people still had driver licenses that were issued in 2005 and they expired in 2012. So after that, people weren't able to reissue them or were able to have a license, you know. So that's still one big thing that people in the community want. It's a driver license. Apart from fighting, you know, anti-immigrant bills all the time, I think that's another thing that's happening in the immigrant community. I know that here in Buncombe County too, there's certain groups that are also working to change certain school policies, because I know that, for instance, like, you're not able to be a volunteer at your children's school if you don't have an ID or a social security number. So what has been done here in Buncombe County by Nuestro Centro and CPC is also, you know, changing that policy. And now you have folks that are able to be volunteers at their children's school. And I know that that's another thing. Education then comes into play also. So higher education for undocumented folks, you know, you are not able to enroll in certain schools. And also you don't have access to
grants
and things like that. So scholarships for undocumented folks are, you know, have been coming out more and more since 5 years back. But I know that that's another push, higher education, to get folks into colleges and universities to change their policies and allow folks to be there. Because also, I mean, you can go, but you have to pay out-of-state tuition, mm-hmm. Which is three times as more than the in-state tuition. So it makes it harder for people to, you know, attend higher schooling. And then just certain programs that are locally, you know, for instance, the 287G programs, which, you know, it allows for police to work as to do the work that immigration does.
So communities.
Secure communities is also, it's kind of like the thing that comes underneath 287G. Okay. So for instance, Hendersonville was a 287G county. So right now I think North Carolina has six programs out of the seven that were in North Carolina, because this year too, it was a crucial year where the 287G programs, the contracts, because they're contracts that that the local sheriffs were up for renewal. So I know that some of those didn't renew. Mm-hmm. I believe Hendersonville was or still is thinking about, you know, renewing the 287G program. And I know that, for instance, Buncombe County was part of the secure communities, where anyone that went into the sheriff's department, mm-hmm. They were, you know, getting their fingerprints, and then those fingerprints were being sent to immigration. And they had 48 hours to communicate between immigration to see if they wanted to come and pick those people up. I know that program, Secure Communities, has changed names, and they have a different but similar course. So now it's called Priority Enforcement Program, which is PEP program. And that's something that we're working right now also to see how we can get the Buncombe County Sheriff to have transparency about how much contact they've been having with immigration and what extent that communication has been. And mainly with this program, the PEP program, which is, you know, the only program that either exists or is not very clear, mm-hmm. here in Buncombe County. So we're trying to get that transparency. And not only here in Buncombe County, but I think it's something that's happening in the whole country, where they're trying to have, you know, more transparency about these programs with the community, since the sheriff's departments and sometimes the police departments aren't very transparent about their communication with immigration or to what extent their relationship takes place. So yeah, so those are some of the things that are happening within the immigrant community. And then, of course, elections are coming up. So that's also, you know, there's a lot of what ifs. For instance, if Trump wins, what happens? If Hillary wins, what happens? There are a lot of things that are, you know, just kind of up in the air. But I'm sure if either one win the presidency, I know that there'll be a lot of organizing to either, you know, insert in programs or to just to to ask to advocate for more pro-immigrant conclusions or solutions.
It's kind of funny, and it's been pointed out a couple times that I've heard. And like, we have a Democratic administration that's been in the White House for the last 8 years, and they followed in the footsteps of George W. Bush, and who was told, like, really reactionary and, you know, pretty reviled by a lot of people. But it's been the Obama administration that's actually deported more people than any other president in history.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people would be surprised to hear that just because of, you know, how the Obama administration seems like such an immigrant-friendly from the outside. But, yeah, he's actually he's known to be the deporter-in-chief. I think 2 years ago he was in the 2 million 2 million people being deported, so it's kind of more 2.5 million maybe now, in that range. But yeah, it's the most that, you know, we've seen in any presidency, even George Bush, like you mentioned, do. And he has done some relief programs, but I feel like not enough to help the immigrant community to the extent that he has the authority and the power to do so.
What's your impression of how DACA and DAPA have worked out? Like, has that been a boon, or has it been a complicated thing? Or
so I think that DACA,
which is deferred action for
childhood arrivals. So DACA was issued in 2012, November 2012, and that has helped, you know, a lot of youth that were coming in. You know, so if you were 16 to 31, you could qualify for this program. And then there was an announcement in 2014 for DACA, the DACA expansion and DAPA. And those programs would help youth that didn't qualify for the DACA, the initial DACA program. And then DAPA, which was the deferred action for parenthood, for parents of, you know, either U.S. citizens or residents that were here in the U.S. In 2014. And unfortunately, those two, the last DACA and DAPA programs didn't come through because of the court hearing. I believe it came into a draw at the Supreme Court, and then it's going back to Texas to see what they can do, even though in Texas was where they chose not to implement it. Mm-hmm. And of course, it all started because of the federal lawsuit. That's the reason why, I guess, the Obama administration wanted to go to the Supreme Court to fight it off. But yeah, so DACA has helped a lot. You know, I think as far as the people that are now working documented under this program, I guess, you know, you could see the North Carolina economy has been helped by that, those increase of jobs, of people with skills now are being implemented somewhere where they can legally work.
And that legal work framework allows for, like, more protections for the workers, right? And, like, seems like theoretically it would, boost the wages, like, overall, because you don't have people that are competing, like, underneath the table, but people actually able to get workers' comp and things like that and feed the economy in general because they're getting a more livable wage to support their family and what have you. Like,
Or also, I mean, I think some of that was already happening maybe underneath the table, like you were mentioning, but I think, like, more people are now able to work at institutions or within the North Carolina public area.
It's like schools and libraries and government offices and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, people are actually able to maybe do some of the things that they wanted, that they could do, that they couldn't do before, to go into these jobs that now they can apply for.
So you've named a couple of organizations around here that are working around immigrant solidarity. You mentioned SEMA, which you're involved in. You mentioned CPC, Nuestro Centro. Can you talk a little bit about these groups that are around here that people might be able to engage with and either volunteer or attend events or get news from and keep an ear towards what's going on around the folks in their community that are being focused on around immigration issues?
Yeah. So, for instance, SEMA, we are organizing for the most part here in Buncombe County to try to get this police immigration collaboration out of Buncombe County first, and then try to see how in other areas around us that plays out. And at the same time, you know, we're trying to look for pro-immigrant resolutions within the city policies, because we have to win some local victories first in order for the state to maybe move forward. And apart from that, you know, we have certain campaigns, for instance, like the Elmer campaign, where people can plug in, either, you know, go to the press conferences, or if a certain anti-immigrant bill also comes into play, you know, you could be part of our newsletter and receive those emails so that you know who to contact, who to call, as far as, you know, your local representative, as far as, like, you know, the campaigns around, for instance, like Elmer, like who and when there's an action, you can come in and, you know, be part of that to help amplify the voices of the Asheville community or the Buncombe community. For instance, I know also, like, Nuestro Centro right now is focusing a lot within the school policies here in Buncombe County, and how, you know, they're trying to work with the school to make it a friendlier place for folks to participate and change certain policies that are not very inclusive. CPC is also working, fighting for social justice here in Buncombe County or in Western North Carolina. But one of the things that comes out for me right now is the language justice group that they're developing, which, you know, it's a lot of interpreters that are, you know, they're being trained and going through this, through workshops to have more of a conscious around social justice and interpreting.
And CPC is Center for Participatory Change.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I guess the last question that I've got is, I feel like when people come, like politicians or media pundits or whatever, when they're and even just regular people, when they talk around immigration issues, there's often the language of, like, deserving versus undeserving. Like, they're taking, this is me doing air quotes that you can't hear on the radio, but, like, they're taking our jobs, like, they're changing our culture. Like, there's this sort of thing about the undeserving individual immigrant, and it seems to focus, because it's focused on the individual and saying, like, that criminal or that this or that, it seems like framing things around not just like an individual case, although, like, individuals have feelings, have experiences, change throughout their lifetimes, have values, they fit into a wider network of what is community. And community at one scope is including folks that are documented, folks that are undocumented, folks that are, like, transplants from the Pacific Northwest, people that have, like, moved here from Britain or from Africa or whatever. Like, it's the, like, Asheville and Buncombe County are these networks of different folks with different experiences. Can you just say a few words about, like, maybe in that way, why people should be thinking, people who don't have to think about immigration issues on a regular basis, why they should be? Mm-hmm. And how it benefits their community as a whole.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think for the most part, I think, you know, U.S. history has a long history of, you know, if you're in the U.S., you're an immigrant no matter what, unless you're, you know, in a Native American or your family comes from another country. Mm-hmm. So I think as far as that piece, you know, we're all immigrants here in this country. And I think if you're not thinking of immigrant rights, you should, because all of our lives are intertwined. And just because, you know, there's so many different, it's so many levels that people's lives are being affected, and how and why they came to the U.S. in the first place, it plays out, you know, on maybe on the coffee that you drink, maybe on, you know, your daily drive to your work, what shirt you're wearing, where your clothes come from, where your food comes from. I mean, I know that, for instance, as far as, you know, food-wise goes, if you're eating, it's because a farmer is, you know, working with those crops. And for the most part, those people are coming here with an H-2A visa, which is a temporary visa for, you know, maybe 6 months. But folks are coming from other countries, from Mexico, from Guatemala, from El Salvador with these visas. And they're here working on, you know, pretty much getting low-wage payments to give us food. And also, you know, the way the corporations work, where they take jobs to another country for cheaper labor and get away with, you know, not paying as much taxes or whatnot, how that affects also the countries where people are living. And, you know, people are making maybe, you know, $10 or $100 a week, if that, working at these corporations or factories that have moved from the U.S. out. So I don't think it's as much as of the immigrants taking, you know, people's jobs, as much as, you know, corporations and the corporate world giving or taking these jobs from the U.S. onto other countries, because it benefits the corporations. I know that, for instance, the last couple months and the beginning of the year, with all these raids and all these, you know, things that are happening in other communities, I know that, you know, my African-American community folks and family, you know, I know that we're all going through some of the same things. While, you know, they're killing my brothers and sisters in one end, they're deporting my other brothers and sisters and taking them to these, you know, private prisons for profit. And then how all these worlds come together, you know, we're fighting the same beast, if you may.
I got to say that, like, a few of the events around Jaye Williams' death, I saw a lot of participation from folks from, like, activists that I know from, like, Latino and Chicano communities around here, participating in overlaying and offering language skills, or just, like, giving experience or offering solidarity and support. And I thought that, and very consciously, like, very much, like, you know, we have different experiences in some ways, but share these things. Mm-hmm. My heart goes out to you. Here are my hands. Let me help you. Mm-hmm. I thought that was awesome to see.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I think it's something that's happening here in the, well, here in the whole state, where more and more I feel like the immigrant community is also, and the Black Lives Matter, for instance, the movement, have come and been and, you know, say we're in the same, we're fighting the same thing, you know, we have to come together to become stronger, to be in solidarity with one another. And I know that's conversations that have been in the past years, but, you know, it's never been like, how can we all come together, even, you know, with allies, with other folks. But I feel like this time around, for some reason, I feel like it's just bringing all these movements and all these people together to become, I think it's the opportunity to be, you know, more inclusive, more just more together than ever before. And I don't know if that's the Donald Trump effect or what it is, but I feel like it's a lot of different factors that, you know, are being put into this bigger picture, being together. So yeah.
Sweet common enemy.
Yeah, sweet common enemy. But yeah,
Well, Bruno, thanks so much for chatting.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's
and
awesome.
So yeah, if people want to just, so we have, you know, we have our website. So if you want to learn more about what SEMA's doing, go to semawnc.org, or you can also see us on Facebook, SEMA, Compañeros Inmigrantes de las Montañas en Acción. You know, there's our email information at the website and also on Facebook. But yeah, thank you for having me.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can send us emails with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.